And you know, they're saying, oh, if you're creating these permissionless censorship resistant protocols that can be used by people for nefarious purposes, then you, as a software engineer, should be responsible for anyone who abuses the power that this software gives to them. And you know, that's really what I find ridiculous, because you can generally use any tool for good or evil. And you know, just because a tool can be used for bad things does not negate all of the good things that it could be used for.
Okay, we're back. Got an awesome guest today, Jameson Lopp. He's co-founder, chief security officer at Casa HODL. And yeah, he's done a huge amount for Bitcoin education as well over the years. He's been around since I think probably before Bitcoin was even created. No, just joking. He's one of the good guys in the space, in my opinion. Always got great perspectives around stuff, very outspoken about Bitcoin. Some people might label him as a Bitcoin maxi. I see him a lot more kind of like in-depth, kind of more sobering perspective around it as opposed to hardcore. Jameson, welcome. It's really good to have you, and I really appreciate you making the time to be with us. Welcome.
Yeah, great to be here. Yeah, I mean, I identify first and foremost as a cypherpunk, as a crypto anarchist, you know, libertarian-minded person. Bitcoiner is a little lower down because I think that's one of the tools in our toolbox. But I have a really, really long essay I wrote a few years ago about Bitcoin maximalism and the moniker and how it's evolved and how I consider myself a Bitcoin maximalist, but I am also continually going to remain open to evaluating new tools and technologies and anything that I believe can further my goals of, you know, enhancing individual freedom and fighting back against the powers that be. So I do certainly piss off a number of what I call the Bitcoin Puritans who think that like I shouldn't be looking at other things. I should only focus on Bitcoin stuff. Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm a bit more open-minded than most, and sometimes that gets me in trouble, but I'm not going to apologize for continuing my personal mission.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the other things that I wanted to add into the intro, but obviously doing intros, you kind of like miss out, but I'll add it, is like kind of like a jack of all trades and also a master of many of those. You know, you kind of like wear many hats, and I'd like to get into that, you know, like, so just give us however you want, kind of like an intro in terms of like your journey in crypto, and particularly your journey with the business that you run at the moment. Yeah, let us have it. Let's hear about, you know, your journey and how you've landed up here today.
Yeah, so you know, I did get into Bitcoin pretty early, 2012. It's been more than a decade now, and I'm coming up on a decade of working full time in the industry. So it was only a couple of years later that I managed to realize that I was, you know, spending all my time on it as a hobby, so I might as well get paid to do it. And spent the first 3 years of my Bitcoin journey full time working at BitGo, building infrastructure there, managing nodes, managing sending queues, fee estimation, getting a lot deeper into the protocol and understanding a lot of stuff about wallets, private keys, self-custody, cybersecurity in general. And then I just pivoted slightly and I took a lot of the lessons that we learned, best practices, tools, hardware, software, and used that to help form the idea that became Casa, which is basically we're trying to provide the most user-friendly, but also high security, high robustness self-custody solution out there, because self-custody is a very complicated thing. There's really no limit to the number of decisions and ways that you can architect self-custody. And so the result of that, if you kind of think of it as this like a decision tree of all these different decisions you make, many of those decisions can take you down a path where you have vulnerabilities or single points of failure, things that can go wrong and result in catastrophic loss. So I basically think of the way that we approach architecting Casa is we greatly limit your choices and how you can set your self-custody, because we're trying to guide you down, you know, the happy path that will minimize the foot guns and the pitfalls. Because really what I think that we're fighting against is human nature. And that is the human nature to prioritize convenience at the expense of almost all else. And this applies to many different things in our lives. But the concerning thing that I see it applying towards Bitcoin is that a lot of people just, you know, buy their coins on an exchange and leave them there forever, and thus expose themselves to a lot of unnecessary risks that Bitcoin was designed to prevent. So people are throwing out a lot of the great features of Bitcoin from the get-go. And we want to give people the confidence that they can do self-custody, that they don't need to trust third parties to do that. And that means we have to make them believe that they are capable of taking on the responsibility that comes with that.
I mean, I think that's great. Once again, like, it's obviously a positive force to have in the space. In terms of business itself, is it kind of like a process of education, like from a business model perspective, are you guys kind of like billing people around the education that goes with that? Because it's almost like it's easy to be dismissive, you know, like as someone who's listening to you, like I know the complexity because I've obviously jumped into what it is that you guys do. But if you hear it for the first time, it's kind of like, well, why do I need someone to tell me how to write a whole lot of like words on a piece of paper, you know, like, and then obviously that isn't the case, but I mean, how do you guys approach it from a, you know, how do you sell this thing? I think that's the question, you know, how do you actually sell it and drive home the importance of the complexity that you just described?
So we offer a few different tiers, and the sort of the entry level, like $20 a month tier, which is this 2 of 3 setup. It's so simple that when you set up one key on your phone, we are automatically encrypting and creating an encrypted cloud backup of that. So like, you don't even have to worry about backing it up. It's pretty much automatic because we have no control over how people back up their seed phrases, like to their hardware devices. We can tell people to do it, but in our experience, you know, a lot of people won't do it anyways, or they'll do it and they just will forget about it or lose it and not take care of it. And so like in that default setup, 2 of the 3 keys are already practically impossible to lose, because one is with Casa and we have multiple redundant backups. The other, that mobile key automatically has a backup. So even your other hardware device, whatever it is, you should back it up, but if you don't, you can still lose it and we can help you recover from that. Now, at the higher level tiers where you have more keys, like a 3 of 5 setup, that comes with a higher level of service. So you have a dedicated client advisor you can get on phone calls with. We can walk you through the process of setting those up and backing them up. So there is a more hands-on, high-touch process. And in addition to that, we have functionality. We were, as far as I'm aware, we were the first ones to ever roll out this idea of doing health checks. And so basically the app will periodically, like every 6 months, if you haven't signed anything with a given key, it'll actually say, hey, we need you to sign something just to show that you still have the key. You haven't lost it. You haven't had, you know, hardware failure, key rot, whatever. And this is, I think, one of the more powerful things of our infrastructure that we've set up, is just these types of reminders, because it needs to be a continual ongoing process. A lot of people, I think, do enter into it with this idea of, oh, it's a set it and forget it thing. But there are things that can change over time. So you do need to be regularly monitoring the state of your self-custody.
Nice. Okay. So, I mean, obviously, there's an importance around that. We know that, I mean, I think it's like 4 million Bitcoin have gone missing forever. It is that high, is it? Huh? Yeah.
Probably even higher. It's, you know, it's difficult to estimate, but you can just look at how many haven't moved in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, it's an important aspect of what it is that you guys are doing. And well done for obviously carving a niche in the space. And obviously, with your background, insecurity and the rest of it, I mean, it was obviously a given that you're going to land up doing something like this. I wanted to kind of like veer off to the left and get kind of like a general overview and your thoughts around, you know, obviously a lot to talk about around obviously the ETFs and the way that, you know, things have played out. I'm not necessarily that interested around the price aspect of things. I think that's not what I believe Bitcoin to be about. I think it's more, I'm more interested in like the idea that Bitcoin was about the individual for individuals and kind of giving us that self-sovereignty and the power around money and where it potentially goes to from here and whether there is a risk of us as individuals giving it away into the hands of those that then get to determine its trajectory, you know, outside of the individual. Just, I mean, I know that that's a bit of a big one, but it's a topic that I feel very strongly about. And I'm just curious as to, you know, what, where your thoughts are and, you know, where do you see it potentially going from here?
So, you know, decentralization is the buzzword that people generally throw around, and there are many different ways to measure centralization or decentralization of a given system. And one of them, like with regard to ETFs and sort of institutionalization of Bitcoin, you know, when you've got these big players coming in that actually fall under regulations where they're actually not allowed to self-custody, they have to use a quote unquote qualified custodian, which I believe is this ridiculous, antiquated, traditional financial concept. That is one of the many dangers that I see looming on the horizon and why I've spoken up several times about my concerns around the ETFs, mainly because like 90% of the ETFs are all using the same custodian at Coinbase. I mean, look, I have owned I owned GBTC for many years. I switched my GBTC to FBTC, that's Fidelity's, because it's just an ideological thing because Fidelity is the only ETF that actually custodies their own coins. And you know, I own these things because I have IRAs and 401ks, you know, these tax advantaged accounts, and that's kind of limited my choices as to what I can do with those funds if I don't want to take a big tax hit of taking them out before retirement age. So the ETFs are one of those vehicles that fall into this category of, you know, extreme convenience. It's very good from the perspective of it has really opened up the markets, the ability for new classes of investors to easily get exposure to Bitcoin as a financial asset. But of course, it prevents and limits them from getting exposure to Bitcoin as a sovereign asset. And, you know, I think there's room for all of it. And I can't give like a specific amount of Bitcoin that would be catastrophic to be held in those. It's just this sort of balancing act of, you know, we don't want to get to the point where the majority of Bitcoin is held in like 10 parties' hands, because I think that starts to bump up against potential governance issues and, you know, regulatory and nation state capture.
Yeah, I think that's quite a healthy perspective to have, because I think the only way that we're going to get kind of like fast forwarding the adoption of Bitcoin and the idea of Bitcoin and whatever that might be for whoever's actually looking at it, that the only way that we're going to fast track that or get to a point where we can circumvent what fiat currencies have kind of like imposed upon us is to get that wider adoption through institutions. I think that role is important. I think I have a great fear for, like you said, you know, that's kind of like too many Bitcoin in the hands of too few is not a positive. And I don't think that that's the essence of what Bitcoin was created to do. I'm curious what the thoughts are from your side of things and, you know, in terms of your belief system, around kind of like the political like machinations that have played out over the last couple of months. And, you know, a lot of people talk about it being a bipartisan issue, but now it's become kind of like almost like a favored Republican narrative in many ways, if, you know, kind of like crypto Twitter is anything to go by. But let's assume that it is. I mean, what does the political landscape for Bitcoin look like? And do we ever arrive at a point where it is truly bipartisan?
I think it's about incentives. And so, one of the many side projects that I have is BitcoinPoliticians.org, where I'm tracking the United States members of Congress and which ones actually own Bitcoin. Because a number of them speak favorably about it, but even amongst that subset, a lot of them don't actually own it. So you do have to wonder whether they're pandering or they actually believe what they're saying. So point being, my belief is that like we need to get more politicians actually owning Bitcoin, skin in the game, and that is going to be a stronger incentive for them to follow through and hopefully follow this line of thinking of, well, I'm a Bitcoiner and I don't want authoritarian regimes telling me what to do with my own assets. But it's tricky. I mean, it's weird to me because the Democratic Party, 15 years ago was actually more of the like anti-big bank, Occupy Wall Street folks. And now they've kind of flipped the script on that. They seem to be more captured by the big banks. They seem to want more control and to, keep the traditional financial system more entrenched and just continually beat on everyone who is trying to build crypto projects that are, not under the purview of regulators and various law enforcement in this ecosystem. So unfortunately, it does seem like the Republicans are a bit of a softer touch on that. And what I've said for a while is, we're not asking for any help from government authorities. We just want you to leave us alone, let us build stuff. If we're not directly harming people, then why do you need to continually threaten us with, basically regulation by enforcement? And while this hasn't really directly affected our business, because we're pretty simple in what we offer with self-custody and not doing in any of the more cutting-edge DeFi stuff that seems to be more under the crosshairs of SEC and other authorities, it's a looming threat where we see verbiage being proposed that would even go to the extent of regulating self-custody and requiring things like AML, KYC, or onerous reporting around self-custody, which it doesn't match up with requirements for, ownership of other like non-crypto assets. So it seems like the people who are more heavy-handed, they actually want a higher level of control over the crypto stuff than they've even really asked for with some of the traditional financial stuff.
Yeah, it seems it's well, there's that saying, it's don't listen to what they say, watch what they do. And it's, you have, once again, coming back to, the political side of it is that, like we want to support crypto and we want regulation. This is what obviously we've heard from the Democrat side of things. And then 2 days later, the SEC is obviously issuing some kind of a, some kind of a warrant, for lack of a better word, and that's, we saw it with Uniswap yesterday, and you've been doing this and you must pay this fine, and there's no real clear, there doesn't seem to be a clear, almost like directive. The directive is that we want things to be this way. It's more like these kind of like pockets of like, you must do this, and if you don't do this, then that will happen, as opposed to, well, here's the regulatory landscape. And I'm just curious as to, like from an American perspective, like you as someone who I assume lives in America and is, like an American citizen, assuming that you are, I mean, how do you navigate that if you are someone who believes in crypto and you have supported the Democratic Party for, like your whole life? How do you actually navigate that going forward? It's like,
Different countries operate differently just with regard to how their legal systems work. I couldn't tell you. I think like Russia and China, for example, operate under regimes where at a very high level, the only things that are legal for a citizen to do are the things that are explicitly codified as legal to do. So like the default is, if something's never been done before, it's actually illegal because the government has to tell you that it's legal. Now, the nice thing about America and hopefully in a number of other Western countries is that it's more permissive in the sense that if something is not expressively codified as illegal, then it should be legal by default. So, you know, that's where we are in America. However, the bureaucratic regime and the regulatory monster that has evolved over the past several decades within America is such that while there's a lot of stuff that is not expressively illegal, it's not legal either. And there's this weird gray area where the regulators have an immense amount of power to arbitrarily decide what is legal or illegal kind of on a whim. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we see pushback on is this regulation via enforcement action rather than via actually codifying laws that people can follow. It's like there are a lot of entities in the space have been asking for clarity just so that they can know what is safe for them to do. But the regulators fairly craftily have refused to do that because they want to have the flexibility to, you know, make these arbitrary decisions. So I do think, while I'm generally not a fan of government in general, it would be nice if we could just get some more laws on the books that would expressively codify things like self-custody as a right that cannot be compromised or have, you know, additional requirements handed down upon us, just so that we can continue operating without having this sort of dark cloud of uncertainty hanging over us. For example, I think we have seen some European countries that have started clamping down and you're requiring more reporting and KYC even on self-custody wallets. So, you know, we would like to prevent that from happening in America. Actually, I saw a pretty neat talk recently by Jonathan Mohan, who was talking about the FIT 21 legislation, which I think has passed one of the houses of Congress. And, you know, that would more expressively codify some of the rights of what we're allowed to do. And my main point being there is we need to have some sort of higher level of legal authority that effectively quashes the ability of these regulators to have like arbitrary and capricious rulings that are coming out on a regular basis.
Yeah, there was actually a really interesting tweet that was put out this morning where X wins block of California anti-hate speech law. The government cannot force individuals or organizations to express certain viewpoints or adopt specific speech. So I think, you know, even though there is this uncertainty, kudos to, you know, America and the fact that, you know, freedom of speech is something that you guys as Americans hold really dear and really close and really strongly. And I think that says a lot, you know, and hopefully that will serve in this quest to actually find the answers and actually form a basis with which America can actually proceed in the way that you've obviously, you know, demonstrated. So I'm hoping, and I'm being bullish because there hasn't been much bullishness lately in the markets and in general, you know, kind of like, you know, like Europe, like you said, has been, I think, around code. And as someone who does code and someone who is, you know, in the space from a technological perspective, what are your feelings around, you know, the fact that the free speech has effectively been taken out of code? I mean, obviously that's a big topic. Would love to hear what you think about that.
Right. So I think the ability to write and publish code is a right. And that the big point of contention around this, and It's very interesting to me because it goes all the way back to my time in university, where I was one of the first classes that I took as a freshman computer science major was actually this philosophy of ethics in computer science. And you know, ethics in computer science goes all the way back to the early days in like the 70s and 80s when we first started creating machines that had algorithms running in them. And like one of the good examples around that was like some of the early X-ray machines actually had code in them that was buggy and irradiated people and you know, caused harm and even killed some people as a result of their buggy code. And you know, that rose up issues of responsibility of like, well, if you write code that literally kills someone, are you a murderer now? And I think, you know, that's an extreme example, but that is the exact point that a lot of the anti code as unfettered free speech people are trying to make. And, you know, they're saying, oh, if you're creating these permissionless censorship resistant protocols that can be used by people for nefarious purposes, then you as a software engineer should be responsible for anyone who abuses the power that this software gives to them. And you know, that's really what I find ridiculous, because you know, you can generally use any tool for good or evil. And you know, just because a tool can be used for bad things does not negate all of the good things that it could be used for. And if you require the builders of tools to police all of the uses of those tools, you're going to greatly hobble and hamper the capabilities of the tools for good, not just for evil. And you know, in general, you know, criminals are always going to be a bit ahead of the curve when it comes to technology. This is a constant cat and mouse game where criminals are, you know, constantly trying to stay ahead of law enforcement by adopting technologies that law enforcement doesn't understand yet.
For fear of kind of like repeating what we've already spoken about, I really enjoyed a tweet that you put out on September the 2nd. And it's the way that it's been laid out, and obviously the words, they want to control what we say, to control what we hear, to control what we think. And obviously that's a part of this discussion. But what inspired you to actually put that tweet out there? Is this something that you think about all the time? But more importantly, what does this actually mean to you?
Right. You know, I just see a lot of these things as systems of control. And, you know, as I said, I'm a anarcho-capitalist, a crypto-anarchist. I believe in free markets as the best way to advance human civilization, even though it is messier and it is harder to control. I think that's a better way of kind of pathfinding our way forward into economies and means of interacting with each other more efficiently, more effectively, continuing to improve kind of our economic power and leverage. And if we're going to continue to hobble them out of fear of safety, it's similar to a lot of other freedom issues, like in America, for example, with firearms. It's that same type of problem of, well, are you willing to empower the people at the individual level with the knowledge that that also comes with some risk of abuse, that some people are going to abuse that power? You have to look at the flip side of it, of how are we protecting, you know, human civilization in general against the abuse of power of a small number of people. So the short version is, like, I look at all of these things as balances of power, and I generally try to push back against any centralization of power into a few small hands, because regardless of how well-intentioned those few authorities are, that is ultimately going to create systemic risk and the potential for that power to be abused, I think, at a much greater level to cause greater aggregate harm than having, you know, the few random individuals and criminals and malicious people who are going around abusing the power at a small level.
Yeah, I mean, now I have to ask you about, you know, DeFi and kind of like the essence of DeFi. And I know that in general, like a Bitcoin maxi's perspective is that, like, it's kind of like we can't look at anything outside of Bitcoin, yet DeFi is traditionally known as something that's obviously started out as an Ethereum base, from my understanding of it anyways, I stand to be corrected, but it was kind of like EVM and decentralization. And I know that funny enough, you did a talk on DeFi in 2019, as we spoke about before we started recording, and you recently actually retweeted that talk that you did, a younger version of yourself. But obviously the essence of who you were back then is who you are now. And I wanted to just tap into, you know, your general thoughts around DeFi, EVM, and then obviously more importantly around how decentralization and the way that you see the value of decentralization within Bitcoin, how does that potentially transfer into the way that we now understand DeFi? Is it valid? Is it kind of like something that we need to protect and grow? Where is your mind at, and where do you think we go in the current kind of paradigm that is DeFi?
DeFi is kind of a trigger word, because I think a lot of people use it to automatically presume, you know, decentralization and censorship resistance. And part of the consequence of having permissionless systems and the ability for people to deploy almost anything that they can dream up and build within these protocols means that you can build stuff on top of the protocols that looks decentralized, but actually has various aspects of centralization in them. So as I think I spoke about in that talk, one of the big problems with a lot of DeFi projects is that they do tend to make some trade-offs, and that they often actually have administrators or capability for, once again, a small number of people to have a lot of control over a specific project. So unfortunately, you have to do your due diligence, and you have to do a lot of research into each individual project to actually understand what are the guarantees that that project is offering to you. So, if you're using a smart contract, you have to understand all of the features and potentially even flaws and risks of that particular smart contract. This is one reason why Casa was very slow to even offer Ethereum support within our system, because we didn't want to write our own smart contract. So that's a very dangerous game to play. We were waiting for there to be a well-vetted multi-signature self-custody smart contract that withstood the test of time and had tens of billions of dollars secured in it, to give us the confidence that the contract itself was not flawed. But, that was specifically just the Gnosis Safe contract. And when you go beyond that into, any sort of newer DeFi projects, things get a lot riskier. The newer something is, or the faster the protocol or smart contract is changing, the more risk there always is involved. So I guess the short version is DeFi has a lot of potential, but as it stands right now, there's a lot of projects out there that we could call dinos, of like decentralized in name only. And they often provide convenience and functionality that you can't get elsewhere, but they do that while hiding some of the risks.
Yeah, I think there is that kind of the evolution that needs to happen. I mean, right now we've seen this new narrative that's come on, and I see the idea around kind of like Bitcoin DeFi or DeFi in terms of Bitcoin, but it's kind of like, well, how do I change the idea of Bitcoin being a savings account into something more than that, in terms of the way that EVM played it, where you can obviously use it as collateral? And now, do you do that within the context of DeFi, or do you then rely on a third party that captures your Bitcoin and then lets you borrow off the back of that? I'm not really comfortable around that. Maybe there are people out there that would be, but that's obviously me giving up my self-custody of Bitcoin. Do you believe that there is a space for that kind of dynamic to exist for Bitcoin, like just purely from a Bitcoin perspective? Or do you think there's a hard line that needs to be drawn where if I'm kind of compromising the custody of my Bitcoin, then I shouldn't be kind of like putting it at risk? Or do you think there is room for risk based on the appetite that someone might kind of potentially, you know, see in that?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that there's demand for people to use their Bitcoin in more complicated DeFi protocols.
Yeah.
And the result of that is that, once again, we've centralized a lot of the Bitcoin ownership, for example, in Wrapped Bitcoin, which is at least partially custodied by BitGo, which is a former employer of mine. And, you know, obviously, I have a high regard for them and their practices, but it's still not a great solution if we really want a censorship-resistant type of ecosystem. But, you know, the reason is because of the limitations of the Bitcoin protocol. And, you know, we're seeing now a number of other projects where people are working on building out other, quote-unquote, Bitcoin second layers. But once again, due to the limitations of the Bitcoin protocol, we still have not realized what I would say is the permissionless sidechain vision that a lot of us held about 10 years ago. So the point being that, like, if you want to peg your Bitcoin into some other system right now, you're most likely going to have to give it up to a trusted third party in order to have tokens in some other system that you're then able to use more complex functionality around. Now, this is one reason why I think that we need to keep talking about improvements to the Bitcoin protocol solely from a functionality and scalability perspective. The potential is there for us to make small upgrades to the Bitcoin protocol that would allow us to build second layers that do not require going through a trusted third party in order to move your funds back and forth. And it's been a really slow going process, a number of different proposals out there, and it's not clear how long it's gonna take until we get there, but It's nice to see progress being made. I think just last week, $1 million fund was established solely to do, I think it was zero knowledge rollup research, or no, it was opcat related research, with the goal, of course, of building things like rollup second layers that could help accomplish some of that. So suffice to say, we've made like one step forward, one step backward in that direction, but there is a path forward, and I'm going to keep pushing for us to keep trying to make progress in that direction so that we can get to a future where people can operate more sovereignly and do some of these more esoteric functions without trusted third parties.
Yeah, I mean, you, in that talk that you did, the one thing that I really enjoyed and that stood out for me is that you distinguished in not so many words, and in so many words, the difference between distribution and decentralization in the current form. And obviously the importance of true decentralization is that almost equal distribution you know, within the network, which I think in many regards Bitcoin has managed to achieve, irrespective of having bigger mining operations. From my understanding of it, it is the most efficient kind of network that humans have ever built. And I think that's one of the coolest things that Bitcoin brings to the table, besides the fact that, you know, we can obviously send money to one another and the store of value that exists. But just coming back to the discussion around kind of like, and you hit the nail on the head, by the way, kind of like the definition from a third party that I interviewed last week, who run a website called Bitcoin Layers, where they're an independent research company. They don't do tokens. There's none of that kind of like BS that's going on. It's kind of like, well, let's look at a sober and academic view of what is actually going on with these different layers in inverted commas. And the classification right now is that every single layer in inverted commas that has been built is essentially a sidechain. And the greatest security risk between that is that communication or bridge between Bitcoin itself and the layer that exists from an EVM perspective and a smart contract perspective. And it's really cool to actually hear you speak about it, because the last thing I expected was kind of like a more Bitcoin maximalist perspective to be obviously sober and cognizant of the fact. So well done, sir. Respect once again for actually like being aware of that. And it's like, I love the fact that you're speaking about, well, how do we actually further the space? It's not just about absolutes. The absolute is the following, and anything over and above that is not an option. And I think that's what's important here. It's like you say, you know, like even though it's one step forward, one step back, there's really an important point of discovery here. Like there is an experiment ultimately, or various experiments that are running. And it's like, we've got to like find better solutions. I don't believe that Bitcoin can just be a one or two dimensional, you know, entity. I think it's got so much more potential. And there's so much that I don't think we've even come to realize, that the only way we're going to find out is doing this whole thing, what you guys are doing from a custodial perspective. It's not just a piece of paper. You know, there's something more there. And it's like, I think that ownership is the journey. And then more importantly, the fact that you are taking ownership, not only of your keys, but your money, and then being able to actually embark on that journey. Anyways, a little bit of a rant, but it's really cool to be able to speak to someone about this, because generally it's like when I speak to someone, it's like it's more hardcore, you know, and it's like I respect everyone. That's the way that I see it. But I think it's not really about black and white. I think there's a lot of gray areas. And I think it's really important that we actually dive in and figure out, you know, where do we go from here and what's next? So that's the question. What is next for the space that is Bitcoin and you know, the whole idea of money?
Well, I think if we don't continue to evolve the protocol and make it more developer friendly for people to build side chains that are actually permissionless and censorship resistant, then you end up with one of two things. But either people end up using other protocols, like more of the Ethereum, Solana, whatever stuff, which from a competitive perspective, you could argue that, you know, that means that Bitcoin is losing some market share for some desired set of functionality that the Bitcoin protocol itself does not support. Or even if people do build more of these so-called Bitcoin second layers, but they're all centralized and permissioned, either way, people end up putting their money with trusted third parties, and they can't unilaterally get that money back. They're essentially dealing with IOUs. And so, you know, that throws out a lot of the security that Bitcoin provides to you. So, you know, really where we're standing right now, if you want to be a sovereign Bitcoiner, then you're either doing the, you know, digital gold store of value use case, where you're doing what Casa provides as functionality, which is, you know, secure cold storage, and you're not really doing very much with it other than holding on to it as a store of value asset. Or if you want the payments rails functionality, you can operate Lightning nodes and operate on the Lightning network in a sovereign fashion, though it is a bit more complicated. But I would argue, Lightning's probably the only pure permissionless layer two right now. If you want anything beyond that, you're giving your money to someone else, or not necessarily a single provider, maybe a federation, but ultimately you're giving it to some other, the control is going into some other entity's hands, and you have to politely request to get your money back and hope that they honor that request, which is for some of these things, it's slightly better than just having all of your money at an exchange that's regulated and could arbitrarily cancel your account for any number of reasons. And we haven't seen much censorship of these federated networks, but they also have not received much adoption, in comparison to DeFi on non-Bitcoin networks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. And I don't have an opinion of this at the moment. So it's not a loaded question in the slightest. There's two very distinct views around the Lightning Network. I think I've heard a lot more people say that it's been a failure versus people who have said that it's been successful. What are your thoughts around the Lightning Network? And you're 100% correct. Just having spoken to the guys at Bitcoin Layers, it's the only one that actually features like on all levels, there's no bridging. It's like it's secure on all accounts. It's the most, like you said, it's the most pure and the most like kick ass out of all the layers at the moment. Yet there's some people who think it's been a failure. And I'm just curious as to, what you think about it.
So whenever you are bridging your funds to a second layer protocol, there's a lot of game theory involved. So if you're doing it in a sovereign manner, like with Lightning, that means you have to be vigilant. You have to be running a node and software to constantly ensure that you're not being defrauded. And so the level of technical sophistication that's required for that goes up significantly versus just having keys in cold storage on a few devices scattered around. That pretty much immediately pushes a lot of people out of being in that position. And once again, drives them towards, using a trusted third party to manage a lot of that complexity for them. And we already saw some of the potential downsides to that in America. I think, several of the centralized Lightning wallet services out there actually stopped accepting American users. Once again, because of the sort of regulatory environment and the gray area and the potential that they could get labeled as money transmitters. So there's a lot of work to be done. Lightning hasn't failed. You could argue that maybe it hasn't grown and been adopted as fast as we would like, but it's also not finished either. There are plenty of potential improvements to Lightning that could greatly enhance the scalability and flexibility for people to operate Lightning nodes and channels in a self-sovereign fashion that would not be as difficult. But once again, it would require more changes to the base protocol. And so with some of the more hardcore, like pro-ossification people who don't want to change the base protocol ever again, that puts us between a rock and a hard place, because if we can't improve the Bitcoin-based protocol, it makes it a lot harder to make improvements at higher layers. And so that's one of the main things that I'm pushing against lately. Even if you just look at the history of Lightning, we wouldn't have Lightning if we hadn't made three different changes to the Bitcoin base layer to enable the functionality and game theory that drives it. So my main point, without trying to go into the minutia and get people's eyes to glaze over, is that it is possible for us to make tweaks at lower layers that then have order of magnitude improvements in functionality of what we can then enable people to do at higher layers.
Nice. Just in terms of, just before we wrap it up, because we're almost kind of like at the top of the hour, just in terms of, you know, another very strong point is like privacy and you know, all of those good things. What are your thoughts around kind of like the, a lot of people argue that Monero is almost like a version of what Bitcoin could have been. And I'm just curious, like, do you think there's a place for privacy in general outside of Bitcoin, or do you think that Bitcoin is sufficient for, you know, maintaining a level of privacy?
Well, Bitcoin has terrible privacy. So, I would certainly love to see more improvements around Bitcoin privacy, but I do not think that we're going to see like a Monero or Zcash level of privacy on the Bitcoin base layer. The primary reason for that is a lot of those really strong privacy protocols require, you know, obfuscating the total amount of the supply. So you're often requiring breaking the ability to audit the total supply of funds. And that's like a hard no, I would say, for pretty much everyone in the Bitcoin space. I think that if we're going to attain that level of privacy, it does need to be at second layers. And, you know, Lightning is much more private from that perspective. And we can do even better with, you know, other side chains that, you know, you could potentially build a side chain that has, you know, Monero like properties with ring signatures, for example. But once again, I wouldn't push people to use that unless we did it in such a way that it was permissionless and it was had, you know, attributes that were more similar to Lightning Network, where you could unilaterally enter and exit from that protocol.
So, I mean, just from the Lightning Network side of things, you've piqued my interest. Is that you saying that the way that Lightning actually transcends and gets to its full potential is obviously the growth of the network itself? Does that mean that more people running nodes is necessary, or do we need to see kind of like better technological advancement on a code level in terms of improving it in its current form?
I mean, some of both. You know, I think the privacy characteristics of Lightning today are already pretty good, but not if you're using a third party. So, you know, if you're not running your own node, if someone else is running that node for you, then they know everything that you're doing on Lightning. Yeah. And so that comes with the, you know, potential risk of, for example, nation state or some authority coming in and basically forcing that provider to reveal all of the private information. Perhaps we could get to the point where we could sufficiently obfuscate what was happening on Lightning Network to the point where even the node provider doesn't have all that information. I haven't really seen any proposals along that line, but another thing is that there are potential improvements like, I think, Sighash no input, any pre-vout that could enable this concept of Lightning channel factories, which would give us order of magnitude improvements for basically people to share Lightning channels. And so, like, from the privacy perspective of Bitcoin, there are a number of proposed improvements out there. Once again, none of which we have any idea when or if they will get implemented. But the potential privacy improvements that could happen in Bitcoin would mostly be around more sharing of UTXOs and kind of making the current state of Bitcoin mixer technology even stronger. I was actually on a panel a couple months ago at Bitcoin 2024, where we talked about cross input signature aggregation, which is another one of those potential protocol improvements. And to kind of sum all of this all up, I'm generally bearish about privacy for privacy's sake, because in my experience, almost nobody cares about privacy until it's too late. But one of the reasons that I like several of these privacy proposals is the incentives that are driving them. And essentially, they would incentivize people to use them by making it cheaper to use Bitcoin in a pro-privacy fashion. So I do hope that we can continue to, you know, iterate on those and eventually get some of them implemented.
I mean, it sounds like a Trojan horse, and it sounds like a net positive Trojan horse. So it would be a good thing. Privacy is never going to be a bad thing. Like you say, it's always too late when you realize you need it. Okay, on that note, top of the hour. Jameson, thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you, and I know you're busy, and it's really appreciated. Thanks for joining us, and look forward to watching kind of the development of CASA and what you guys are doing, and all the best.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, everyone. Be sure to like and subscribe, provided you liked it and you want to come back for more, and join us next time. Thank you.
All right, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a like, subscribe, and turn the notification bell on for next time. See ya.